This podcast is produced by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. KPP Financial. Independent thinking, shared success. And now today's podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our November 27th, 2017 edition of Invest Talk. And as always, we are here to help you become an above average investor. And it's difficult out there to decipher what is important from what is just noise, especially in the media today. And our job here is to open up a two-way conversation with you about your money. And my job as a financial advisor and as a risk manager is to really talk about the risks that are out there, what's important for you as an investor, and how to make better decisions. And as investors watch the market steadily climb to record highs, our memory from, you know, almost a decade ago becomes even further and further in the rearview mirror, and we kind of get lulled into some complacency. But risk is always there. Whether that shows up today or tomorrow or next week or next month is another question. Just because it hasn't hit you doesn't mean that that risk isn't prevalent. You just tend to pay attention to it when that risk is actually there and showing up in your portfolio. So how do we keep our risk exposure right-sized for our personal situation? We all have our own sets of goals, our own sets of assets, own risk tolerance, and our own way of going about our investing journey. Right? And that's why you're here. That's why you're listening to us, is you're on your own journey, and everyone's journey is a little bit different. And figuring out your journey is really what Invest Talk is all about. So everyone's invited to use our 24-hour listener line. It's 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278 is how you get through and ask your question live during our 4 to 5 Pacific time hour, or you can always call after hours, leave a message, and we'll get to it on an upcoming show. And we'll get to that in a moment. Once again, that number is 888-99-CHART. That's how you get through and ask your question on today's Invest Talk. Now, knowledge and discipline are really the two main weapons you need to employ to make better decisions and avoid unnecessary risk, excessive risk, and to make the right decision for you. Now, one of the types of risks that gets ignored by many average investors is something we call concentration risk. And this happens when an employee buys too much of his own employer stock, or just you fall in love with a particular company and you put double-digit percentage of your portfolio in that one particular company. And somewhat of a portfolio concentration is not a bad thing. You don't want to be spread too thin. We certainly see clients who have way too many stocks out in their portfolio to really be effective. But then you can go on the other side of the pendulum and have too much concentration even in just a handful of stocks or a handful of sectors, right? Ignoring one complete sector as a whole, or really just falling in love with tech stocks. You know, think of the tech stocks of the late 90s. Even today, we have somewhat of a tech bubble in real estate stocks or real estate investing back in the mid-2000s. So this happens a lot, like I said before, when you have too much in your own employer stock, which is a double whammy, because what if you lose your job? You know, that business, that company is the sole, is very tied to your financial picture, your financial future. So if you lose your job because of, say, a downturn in that particular company, not only are you getting hit from the equity side going down because the business overall is going down, but you're also losing your income as well. So you never want to have too much exposure to one particular area of the market, one particular stock, and especially your own employer stock. We always say 5% is probably the extreme. A lot of people have good advantageous ways to buy their own employer stock, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? They get it at certain discounts, and that can be a good thing. So having maybe 10% of your overall nest egg in your employer stock is not the end of the world, but you probably don't want to go much higher than that. So a lot of people use a strategy where they buy that at a discount and they sell it on a systematic roll kind of thing, but they never let it get too big a percentage of their portfolio. So that's something you should always look out for, is being overexposed to that type of risk of one particular asset. And then there's the mutual fund defense. And some people think that if they invest in a mutual fund, they've taken care of their diversification needs. And that's certainly true in some cases when you have a very diversified, maybe balanced type of mutual fund that holds equities and bonds, etc. But there are certainly funds, ETFs out there, that are too concentrated in a particular sector. Or think of like a growth fund, a growth mutual fund, a growth ETF. They're certainly going to be very tied to the technology sector, and so you have a higher risk there, and that might be appropriate for you, but it also may not. It depends on what your risk tolerance is, and you have to look at valuation as well. And anything that is probably growth related is probably, in this market, expensive in relation to history. And value is probably at a lower valuation relative to growth stocks in history. So understanding that mutual funds help, or ETFs help, but they aren't the panacea, let's say that. Now time to go to our 24-hour listener line now and check for your questions. And here's one that came in before today's Invest Talk.
I have a question of what you think about in the long term, like 10 years or maybe a little bit longer, for the pro shares, the ultra funds that they have for the NASDAQ 100 or the S&P 500. They have the ultra funds, which will give you a double, hopefully. And I was wondering what you think would be best in the long run, the QQQs or the S&P 500. Thank you.
This is a great question. We get this a lot, and in times like this, when markets are trending, the ultra funds, the leverage funds, we're talking about anything that's really a leveraged ETF, or there's some leveraged mutual funds out there. In good times, they're great, right? They double the leverage, double the return, but over the long term, they don't do well. In rough times, they tend to go down a lot more than would be expected. There's called tracking error, which is a complex mathematical term, which just means that over the long term, they don't track double the index. And so through the ups and downs, you're going to actually underperform the overall index, if you put in a bear market in, you know, any extended period of time, which is certainly you're going to find that. But in the long term, if you're just a buy and hold, you just want to stick with the unlevered index. But if you're trading, you're swing trading, you're momentum trading, certainly those leverage funds can be very helpful. But the odds are, in the long run, they're going to underperform the index because of that tracking error. So always be careful. Any leverage fund, any leveraged ETF, leveraged mutual fund is going to have that tracking error, and it is a trading vehicle only. Now, you might be able to hold it for a few weeks, maybe a couple months, but you probably don't want to do much longer than that. So I hope that clarifies your question, and hope that gives you a little bit more perspective on leveraged funds. Now, financial advisor Justin Klein, how close are you to paying off your house? Steve and I always recommend to have your house paid off by the time you retire, and then you can buy a can of paint, you can fix it up, you can do whatever you want to it, and you don't have that overhead of paying that mortgage on a consistent basis, and it makes that financial planning chore much, much easier. Now, you can join in now if you have a question about the market, particular stock, real estate, bonds, interest rates, whatever it is. I'm open for your money questions now, and join in at 888-99-CHART. Let's go to Wendy in Chino Hills. How you doing, Wendy?
Great. How are you, Jesse? Hope you had a great holiday.
I did. How was yours? Did you eat too much?
No, not too much. Yeah, I actually...
Just enough, just the right amount.
That's good.
Okay, that's good. I did my best as well. What can I do for you?
Okay, wonderful. So today's question is regarding ETF, VIGI. I want to know, for general, if it's a good holding for the next few years, say 5 to 10. And also, I checked their, dividend from different quarters, different times. The dividend amount, the cash amount is very erratic, I think. Sometimes, 0.5, and then, I'm checking right now, the next one in December sometimes is only, 0.5, very little. So what makes it so erratic for their dividend?
Gotcha. Well, first off, this is an international fund. This is the Vanguard International Dividend Appreciation ETF, and is this closed end or not? No, it looks like an ETF. Yeah, it's an ETF. So it's going to trade around the NAV. And one of the reasons why it's so erratic is because they're international stocks. So you're going to have some foreign currency translation variations throughout the year, as foreign currencies go up and down in value. And a lot of companies, foreign companies, they tend to not pay as consistently as American companies, right? Most American companies that pay a dividend pay on a quarterly basis. There are many foreign companies that only pay annually. Some pay semi-annually. Some do pay quarterly. But it's just a little more erratic in that sense. So you're not going to get that consistent dividend income on a quarterly basis that you would get from most American companies.
Okay. For the ETF, is it a good hold for the next few years?
Well, I one thing I like is that it's international, and I think there's definitely better value abroad than there is here in America. So I like that. The expense ratio is about 0.25%, which is relatively low, especially for an international fund, which tends to have higher expense ratio. You have about a 1.67% dividend over the past 12 months. Not exactly exciting, but it is more. This is more of a dividend appreciation fund. So the idea is to invest in companies that, while they pay a dividend today, it may not be a lot, but they're growing, right? They're likely going to increase their dividend over time. I don't think there's enough of a track record. It's only been around for a couple of years for me to really say, this is a great fund or it's a bad fund. What I can say is it's in a good place. It's got fairly low expenses, and it's probably relatively attractive from a valuation standpoint compared to American companies. So from that standpoint, I like it, but you got to understand that you probably will go through a recession at some point in the next 5 to 10 years, and this will be hit just like most other equities. Thanks for calling, Wendy. This is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein, and welcome your money questions, and we can talk live right now, 4 to 5 Pacific Time at 888-99-CHART. .99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let's go to Andre in Palo Alto. How you doing, Andre?
Hey, good, Justin. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, I just wanted to get your thoughts on what you think the next financial crisis is going to be. Is it going to be a debt crisis? I mean, you look at our national debt, $22 trillion and growing. Household debt is at an all-time high. Asset prices are at all-time highs. Housing, the stock market, interest rates are an all-time low. We keep printing money like a drunk sailor. It seems like we're asking for some kind of negative climax here. And I wanted to get your thoughts on what you think it's going to be. Because when it happens, we all know that it happens quickly, And if you're not positioned correctly, it's like a knife falling straight down. And I also wanted to get your thoughts on cryptos as a possible hedge for the next crisis.
Well, every crisis is some form of a debt crisis. Right? If you go back in history, even the dot-com bubble, when it crashed, it wasn't really a crisis. If you look at the economy didn't really crash that much. You know, you had some recession within that industry, but overall, it was a fairly mild recession overall. So every true real panic and crash was some sort of a debt crisis. Now, where is that over leverage today? Where is the lack of borrowing standards prevalent in today's economy? And I think it's certainly, one is the student loan market. Student loan market is driven by the government. There's no real underwriting standards. It's all back there. So there's certainly an issue there, but that's backed by the government, and that's kind of an extension of government debt, and governments can print money. So I actually think the biggest risk is in the corporate bond market. Yield spreads on corporate bonds are near historic lows, meaning the risk that you're taking by buying especially high yield corporate bonds is so extreme compared to the added yield that you're getting in today's market. And corporate leverage is near historic highs, especially compared to profits and cash flow. And so suddenly when you go into a recession and profits aren't there, it's much harder to carry that level of debt. So that's really where I see that going and where the next real crisis could be. And when it comes to cryptocurrencies, I think there's an extreme number of flaws with the whole crypto space. It's obviously the hot topic today, and I think it's very similar to what we saw in the real estate boom in the mid-2000s. I see very similar activity and conversations and people just trying to get rich quick, and really it's an interesting space. I think it has some traction, and blockchain has a lot of usability in certain forms. But in the end, with the problems with blockchain bloat and the energy it takes to run and mine the blockchain, to security issues, to what's the government going to do about it, what regulation is there going to be around this space, and that's just I'm talking surface level problems. There's probably a dozen more that I could get into. I think It will evolve over time, but I think it's going to take a lot longer than people are expecting, and it ultimately will go through a crash and a burn, and there will be a handful that come out of it. And ultimately, I think the actual cryptocurrency that we're using 20, 30, 40 years from now, whenever it does become actually a viable currency, probably doesn't exist today.
Okay. Well, it's not actually, I agree partially with what you're saying, but blockchain is actually mainstream right now. IBM's working with Walmart on an application, a large application.
Yeah, and that's
it's being used.
And that's where it's going to be
used right now. And with cryptos, I mean, if I was the government, any government, I would be worried because it is a form of trade that can eliminate, I know this is idealistic, but it could eliminate the Federal Reserve.
And I agree with you that blockchain is being used, and I do think it will be refined and, I'd say perfected in the private sector. Right, like you said, IBM, they're working with it, and they have control over it, which is one of the issues with decentralization. Is there's pros and there's cons with the decentralization, but when it comes to what you're talking about is replacing the Federal Reserve, I think it's extremely naive to think that the government's just going to go quietly into the night. Remember, This is supposed to be a currency that's used in the physical space. And guess who owns the physical space? Who controls the physical space? Governments control the physical space. So ultimately, governments are going to have a say. Whether we want them to or not, they do. They will. And I agree with you. I'm as critical as the Federal Reserve as anyone out there. But to say that blockchain is the answer and cryptocurrency is the answer, I say it could be the answer eventually. But there's a lot to happen between now and then, both positively and negative, with that space that needs to be watched. Thanks for the call, Andre. Coming up on the next Invest Talk, how to pick the best asset allocation for you. That's next time, but give me a call right now at 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast continues next. First, a couple of words for KPP Financial. Whether you own real estate as an investment or simply as your residence, for most investors, matters of real estate ownership factor into all of our financial decisions. Making buying and selling decisions, considering your options, always part of the evaluation and management of your retirement portfolio, and it's one piece of the retirement puzzle that's often overlooked. It can be challenging. That's why KPP Financial has a licensed real estate agent on staff to help you make the important decisions about your home and your retirement. And to learn more about all of our KPP Financial services and investment programs, just go to investtalk.com and click on the Investments tab. Now let's get back to the podcast. This is Invest Talk, 1 hour of financial news and perspective where you can talk directly with a registered investment advisor. Bring your questions. Our direct line, 888-99-CHART.
Hit 899-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let's go to James in Sonoma. How you doing, James?
Well, I'm doing fine, Justin. You may have answered part of my question to your previous caller, because my question is on PHYZX, which is a Prudential high-yield bond fund. And what we're doing is I'm getting close to retirement here. I've got too many stocks, not enough fixed income, so my guy's saying you need to get more fixed income. He says, I'll even let you have a little bit of high yield. So this doesn't represent much of my portfolio, but he said, we'll put a little bit of high yield in there just to kick it up a little bit. But he wants to get me more into fixed income. And as you know, there isn't a lot of fixed income to choose from out there as far as it's bonds, it's bonds. That's where he's got PHYZX. What do you think of high yield, and then what do you think of that particular one?
Yeah, well, I think you said Prudential earlier, but it's the PIMCO High Yield Fund. And
it's
a pretty good fund.
Okay.
Yeah, it's PIMCO, not Prudential. Yields about 4.7%, which sounds like a nice, decent yield. But then you look at its high yield, it's not really that attractive. And you know, in this environment, high yield bonds are very risky in relation to the yield or premium that you're really getting by taking that amount of risk, especially with the amount of corporate debt that is out there. So, you know, we run different fixed income type strategies, and we have a balanced income program that's kind of similar probably to what your advisor might be trying to move you into, but we use individual bonds, and I think that's the best way to really go about it in this case, instead of mutual funds. In today's world, it's a lot easier to buy individual securities. But high yield, while it's safer than equities, you're not really going down the risk spectrum that much. It's kind of a hybrid fixed income and equity type of security. It's in the middle. So it's not exactly really getting your portfolio that much safer, especially with yields this low on high yield. So while I think the fund isn't bad, I just don't like the timing and this space. I would be either looking for individual bonds where you can go out there, you know, we'll look for particular credits that might be near high yield or just in the very high end of junk, and yielding around this amount or better, but having a much safer risk profile. So that's the way that I would go if you're trying to de-risk your portfolio.
But I have individual bonds, but it's he was just looking for a little something to juice this up. So, I mean, we've got individual bonds. We just, I kept him saying, God, can't we get a little bit more than this? And he said, well, I'll let you have a little bit of this, just a touch, just a taste. And
So I mean, just the taste, it's not the end of the world.
I'm risking too much then.
Well, I just, the risk reward at this time is just not fantastic. It's not, if it's just a touch, you know, I'm assuming that's like 5% of your portfolio. That's what I'm assuming he's talking about.
It's not that.
Not even that, yeah. I mean, it's not going to be the end of the world. You'll get a little bit juicier yield, but don't think that you're really de-risking your portfolio very much if it's coming from equities. It's really not changing the risk profile of your overall picture, and that's really what you're looking for, right? Is first off, is what is that overall risk profile of your portfolio? Is it conservative, moderate, aggressive, etc.? And then is this the best risk versus reward investment out there? And I'm going to say a high yield space isn't at the current time. I think there's other better places to put your money.
Well, thank you very much.
No problem, James. Thanks for calling. That was PHYDX is the symbol. That was the PIMCO High Yield Bond Fund D-Class, D-Share. All right, so glad I could answer those questions. Let's go to our main talking point today. There's a few things that I have on my mind, but ultimately it's up to you what we talk about. I'm going to start off with real estate investing and a guide to real estate investing, but I have some other interesting facts as well. The most interesting one I'm going to get to in a little bit, which is talking about the flattening yield curve. I don't know how many people have been paying attention to that. And in reality, the flattening yield curve is not necessarily a bad thing. A steepening yield curve, and a certain type of steepening yield curve, is actually what you should be most worried about. So I'm going to get to that. Also, what are some signs that the bull market is over? And then is the retail apocalypse, the Amazon apocalypse, really what is that a good thing for a lot of retailers? And we're going to talk about that. Hopefully, if we have time. We only have about 20 minutes left in the show, so I doubt we'll get to all four. But let's start with the beginner's guide to investing in real estate. Investing in real estate really goes back thousands of years, right? Predating the stock market, it was really the beginning of the investment game when it's one of the five basic asset classes out there. And I think for almost everybody, it should be something you at least consider to be part of your overall portfolio. But just like anything, it shouldn't be the only asset in your portfolio, only asset you invest in. But it certainly should be considered. And there's different ways that you can make money in real estate. Obviously, price appreciation is one, by the real estate market just going up in value in that particular area, or maybe you do upgrades to your piece of property that make it more attractive to a potential buyer or renter. And this is actually the place that most people think of real estate and how you make money in real estate. And one of the reasons I understand why is because we've had 35 years of interest rates dropping, and that is a giant tailwind to the price of real estate. And you know, we're entering a phase where interest rates are probably going to stay flat or go up maybe a little, and that's certainly something that is probably going to retard price appreciation over the long term. Next is cash flow from rents. That's certainly the area that is most underappreciated, and I think of real estate investing as a cash flow game. You want positive cash flow, and anything from a price appreciation standpoint is a bonus for me. It's a nice little bonus, and I want to focus on cash flows, okay? And one other way that you can get cash flows is ancillary ancillary incomes from the top property. Besides rents, you might have a vending machine. You might have laundry facilities within an apartment building. These are kind of like mini businesses within your particular property. And there's obviously, if you're a real estate agent, you can get income that way. But, you know, we're really talking about investing. And really, those are the three ways. Price appreciation, income from rent, and then ancillary real estate investment income from those type of third-party type of businesses, mini businesses within it. Now, for many investors, rental income has a huge psychological advantage, right? It over dividends and interest. You know, you can drive by and you can see the property. You can change it however you want. You can use negotiation skills to get rents as high as you possibly can to improve those capitalization rates, or in the industry what we call cap rates. But from time to time, obviously, real estate investors get caught up in the frenzy of price movements, price appreciation, and they ignore the cap rates. They ignore income. And really, that's what, once again, what real estate investing is all about, is focusing on those cap rates, focusing on your actual return from rents, and don't fall for price movements. Because over time, price movements are just going to follow income, right? Because income is what is needed to pay for properties, to rent properties, right, to pay for rents. So incomes matter the most when it comes to price appreciation. And that's really what you should be focusing on from a fundamental perspective, is what are incomes and how much can those incomes support in prices of properties in that particular area. And that's why you want to look at GDP and economic growth for a particular area that you're looking at. And a lot of things are underappreciated when you're investing in real estate, like property and income tax, maintenance on that property, any insurance and other expenses that really go into, think of HOA expenses that go into the carrying cost of that property. It's not just the mortgage that you are paying on that particular property. So, and then you have to add in the amount of time required to deal with that investment. It's not like a bond. It's not like a stock. You have to actually pay attention to it, right? Just because it's paying you that check doesn't mean that there isn't maintenance and problems that arise from owning a particular property. And then you go into, what type of property is there? Are you going to invest in residential real estate? And that can be a single-family house or an apartment building. Those leases tend to run about 12 months, give or take. And that means that it's very sensitive to the movements in the market, both on the upside with prices, rents going up, and the downside. Whereas commercial investing, you know, you're buying office buildings, those leases tend to last many, many years. And that can be a good thing if rents are maybe flat or falling, but it can be a bad thing if rents are going up and you're locked into a lower lease. And then there's certainly industrial real estate investing in strip malls, shopping centers, and then there's mixed-use properties as well. And the simplest way to invest in real estate, though, would be a REIT, a real estate investment trust. And these can be held in a brokerage account, an IRA, a Roth IRA, and that's another simple way of investing in real estate. So I hope that gave you a good overview of how to invest. There are different pros and cons, but ultimately, I think the number one factor that everybody must understand, the biggest mistake you can make is to rely on price appreciation for real estate. It can be a good thing. There's ways that you can get it. There's ways that you can do the analysis to make good decisions on buying low, selling high, etc. But ultimately, real estate is a cash flow game, and making sure that you have good cash flows from the start and find ways to improve that cash flow over time is really the key in the real estate department. Now, is it time for a retirement portfolio review? Maybe a tune-up or a complete remake of your financial situation? Maybe you'd like to explore a new approach. Now, next week, Steve will be in San Jose for individual portfolio reviews, and the date is December 6th. Now, to get on his schedule for that date, just go to investtalk.com, click on the Invest Talk tab, then Portfolio Review.
A survey showed that 73% of investors say keeping my money safe is more important to me than trying to generate returns. Well, Steve takes risk management seriously too, and that's why during his portfolio reviews, he examines retirement accounts with risk in mind, managing it to protect investors' futures. Steve schedules just a few of these individual checkups each month, and if you'd like to reserve your own hour with Steve on Skype or telephone, just go to investtalk.com and click on the InvestTalk tab and then Portfolio Review.
Hello, this is podcast listener and KPP customer Jack in Chicago. I'm looking at a stock, OAK, Oak Tree Capital. The share price took a big dump first part of November. It's been bouncing around a little bit. I'm looking at a forward PE about 9 or 10, maybe 11. Wanted to know what you thought of that stock going forward. Thanks.
All right, he's looking, client, I know Jack. Let's see. Oak Tree Capital Group. This is an investment management company. Invest in distressed debt, corporate debt, control, invest in convertible securities. It's in the asset management game. It yields about 7.5%, which seems pretty juicy, right? I'm sure he's after that nice 7.5% dividend yield. But let's take a look and see if it can sustain that and maybe why it has declined recently. It's been in a downtrend really since March of 2014, where it hit a high of around in the low 60s. And it hasn't been a sharp decline, but now we're in around $42 a share. A ton of debt on their balance sheet. Negative free cash flow. I don't like that. You have a financial leverage of 10 times. Let's look at their payout ratio is 76%, but their cash dividend pay ratio is negative 55%, meaning they're not producing nearly enough cash to pay down that or pay that dividend. So odds are eventually that is going to get cut. That dividend is going to get cut because they can't really support that from a cash flow perspective. Let's look at enterprise value to EBITDA. Is pretty low. 4.7 is a low enterprise value to EBITDA ratio, but let's look at where it has been kind of longer term, because some stocks trade at a premium to enterprise value to EBITDA, others trade at a discount. But where does this look in history for Oak Tree Capital? And I'm bringing that chart up, but let's go back to its debt. I don't like this debt. Wow, its financial leverage has been high for a while. They've reduced it recently. Their revenues are going up dramatically. It's kind of a private equity firm. Wow, this is kind of all over the map. I just don't like it because how much risk you're taking here. They lost a lot of money during the financial crisis. It's going to be very, very cyclical. Ton of debt, 532% debt to equity ratio. Revenues are down 19% last quarter, year over year. Earnings are down 27%. Earnings are supposed to fall next year. Trading at 8x book, which is pretty high. I don't like it. It's just very, very high risk, and it's in a downtrend from a chart perspective. And I would not expect that dividend to stay intact. So I would pass on Oak Tree Capital Group. You're listening to Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein. We have just a few moments left in the hour. Give us a call at 888-99-CHART. Let's go to Jeff in San Francisco. How are you doing, Jeff?
Hey, good afternoon or evening or whatever it is. Real quick question. Mm-hmm. I think I've talked to Peasley on it, but getting your bouncing this off your idea. What do you think of buying the whole, like, a S&P 500 or a NASDAQ? I have a Fidelity NASDAQ fund, basically buys the whole entire thing, replicates it, that type of deal. And then we've got one with Charles Schwab fund, S&P 500. Yes or no? What do you think?
Well, I've talked about this before, and I do think that the everyone's over-indexed. So, especially everyone's crowding into the same funds, the same index, right? Whether that's and that doesn't matter whether it's a Vanguard fund, whether it's a Schwab fund, they're all pushing their money into the same index, and those indexes are market cap weighted. So a lot of that money, most of that money is going into the largest stocks out there, which tend to be the most overvalued in the marketplace today. So from a long-term perspective, it's a poor valuation play. If I'm going to index, I'm going to try to find an index that is not very mainstream. It's not a lot of funds following that particular index. That's why I kind of like the smart beta ones a little bit better. You know, long term, you'll probably do okay. I think the prospect for equities over the next 10 years are certainly lower than average, if not possibly negative. It'll be interesting. You know, usually over a 10-year period, stock market's not negative in any sense. But so I'm not a big fan of the S&P, the NASDAQ. I just think everyone is overcrowded into that trade and that over-indexing. And it very reminds me, again, of the Nifty 50 of the late 60s, when it was just, oh, buy these 50 stocks and you'll do fine. And now it's all about buy this index and you'll do fine. And that's what worries me. So just not a big fan of the major indexes.
Okay, another one then.
That makes sense.
Technology stocks, long-term, yay or nay? Wrong next to you also.
Yeah, once again, you know, everyone, growth, if you looked at our webinar just a couple weeks ago, we talked about the dichotomy between growth stocks and value stocks and how growth has really outperformed strongly over the past 7 years or so. And we're at about 2 standard deviations in performance difference. And usually that is when things turn. This is exactly what happened in the late 90s with tech stocks being the growth stocks of the era. And they were at 2 standard deviations, and you saw what happened then. So tech stocks, no.
Yeah.
Certainly long term, there's certain ones that I really like. You know, I really want to buy Google at some point, because I do think YouTube has a very strong future, and it's one of the best entities out there in the internet today, and there's so much growth and potential for it. But from a valuation standpoint, from being a value investor, so many of them are just extremely overvalued. It irks me to go out there and buy these stocks at just insane price multiples.
Yeah, $600-$700 a stock. I don't have it, so I'm barking up the wrong tree on that one. But I'm buying ETFs
Well, Jeff, I want to correct you real quick. It has zero to do with the price of the current stock, right? Berkshire Hathaway has been B shares, I guess, or A share, whatever the expensive one is, has been hundreds of thousands of dollars for a long, long time. So never, ever, ever think that a stock is expensive because it's trading at $600 a share, or $1,200 a share, or whatever. Most of those stocks that are trading over $100 a share are actually cheaper than the stocks that are trading under $5 a share.
Oh.
Do you understand that?
Okay. Yeah.
Because the value, the overvaluation or undervaluation of a particular stock has zero to do with what price it's trading at. It's what price is it trading at in relation to earnings and cash flow and future earnings and debt on the balance sheet, leadership, brand, etc. That's what matters. I see many stocks that are cheap at $600 a share, and I compare them to a stock that's trading at $30 a share, and the one that's at $600 is cheaper than the ones at $30 from a valuation standpoint. So try not to get boxed into, oh, it's trading at a certain dollar amount, so that's really how expensive it is. That's not how it works. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Time to wrap it up. If you have a 401k that maybe is kind of disappointing you, what's your action plan to tune it up? Take a look at our program called Active 401k. It may be just what you need. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein, Chief Executive Officer of KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. Steve Peasley and I thank you for being with us. And on behalf of the whole KPP family, I want to thank you for being part of the program. Let's meet again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program
be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor.